session number 11744, Rule 1.
Mr. Wright, Rule 1. Can you tell me how you came to join the Air Force and when it was, please?
Well, it's the usual stupid cry. My whole family have been in the Navy, apart from one rather disreputable uncle who was in the yeomanry. And I did have a grandfather who actually fell apart and joined the Royal Marines. But my father was a regular naval character who had been in the Dover Patrol in the First War, the Dover Patrol in the Second War, and submarines after that. Now, when Munich came, poor old Joker was about 45, I suppose. Dear old gentleman. And, of course, he got called up and taken down to Chatham. At that time, I was a Makelan Company cost accountant in the big engineering works. And it struck me, there was that poor old boy, sort of toddling off and came to fight a war. And there was I in a reserved occupation, sitting peacefully in an office up in Euston Road. So I went down to President, you know, which is the Naval Reserve place, and said, you know, what about my joining the Navy? My entire family are in there. And they looked at me and said, don't be so damn silly. Don't dirty our decks. We've got plenty of people that have got perfect sight. We can have any of them. So I got off their decks, and thank goodness I did, because I'd probably have been killed. Went back to the office and looked up Whittaker's and one or two other things and found there was an RAFVR place in London University in Store Street. So I went there, and it was a bit stupid. When I was a kid, I used to go to a school for the partially blind. Only because I was the only one in my family busy going blind at the time. And consequently, you know the sight charts that you get, the Snellen charts, which start on A, B, and finish up with little tiny letters at the bottom. Well, I had a more or less photographic memory at that time. So I went up for the aircrew end of the business and read the sight chart off very happily with my glasses in my pocket. And they turned it over, and I couldn't read the top line, so I nipped downstairs and joined the ground crew section because they didn't turn it over. We used to spend our spare time going up to Biggin Hill because that was the nearest place to Eltham.
When was this, by the way?
Oh, just after Munich, 38, wasn't it?
Yes.
And Biggin Hill, we used to get a postcard about once a fortnight that was sent the previous night from North London. It arrived on the Saturday. On the Sunday, we went off and saw the regulars up at Biggin Hill, and then we went off to the old jail, round in Jail Lane, round the corner, and drank beer with them. That was the sort of sum total of our training, I think. Then in August 39, I was almost due for my inter of the Custom Works Accountants exam. Been working like mad for 18 months for that. And it was apparent there was a war coming, so we'd stopped. Then I got a note saying, report to Store Street yesterday. You're embodied in the Air Force. Yeah. 20 minutes later, my father had a telegram saying, report to Chatham tomorrow. He was not a terribly happy household at that time. So I went up to Store Street and passed another medical. It was about the only exam that I could pass, in actual fact. I'd have failed that Cost and Works Accountants exam anyway. From Store Street, we were bundled off into buses, and I went to North Weald, out just beyond Epping. Very pleasant place. Well, when we arrived there, quite obviously, it being the Air Force, they hadn't got the remotest idea what to do with us. I spent several weeks being a damn good coal heaver. Marvellous job being a coal heaver. I can thoroughly recommend it. You start early in the morning, admittedly, but by 9:30 you've drunk about 14 cups of tea, and your work's finished for the day. In our spare time, you were belting up ammunition for the Hurricanes out there. Yes, two Hurricane squadrons, I think, there were in these days. But sooner or later, I got a job scrubbing the floor in the ops room. Quite how I was wished onto that one, I don't know. But an operations room is a peculiar-looking place. You've a well with a large map in it. It's gridded, rather like an ordnance survey grid. It's purely an outline one. And sitting round it are, in those days, airmen with earphones on. And they had plots from what was then known as RDF, it's now radar, radio direction finding stuff, for the sea areas, and from the observer corps from the land side of it. If you want the technical parts of it, all of the plots were sent up to Stanmore. They were filtered, in other words, they were sorted out so that two or three raids could have, there should have been one, because several people were looking at them. And they were sent back again to the different sector stations. Overlooking the map were a couple of daises. On the centre of the top dais sat the duty controller. On one side of him he had the army with the searchlights and one or two other odds and ends. To his right-hand side were the people who dealt directly with group. You had people drawing maps of any action that happened. And that was that. Very nice, quiet, peaceful pastime. You worked a 3-watch system in the early days. It later became 4 because it became a bit more hectic. The operations room itself was an ordinary brick building on the surface. It had an earth wall around it, but no way of stopping anything very solid. I think a rifle bullet would have gone through it. And behind, underneath the daises were the radio operators who sat there logging everything that was said by the controller or by the aircraft. And, of course, defense teleprinter network rooms where people sat there collecting written orders on teleprinters. Two or three GPO engineers, and that was the full strength of the thing. Now, in those days we had Hurricanes without variable prop propellers on them, fairly slow rate of climb. The radio equipment was very hit and miss. We didn't have the very high frequency stuff. So that all of our talking to aircraft was very slow, very deliberate, and very uncomfortable. In those days, I was a simple, ordinary plotter on the floor. I had nothing to do with radio, with telephones, or anything else. Now, your controller would call up, or Falcon Red Leader, or whatever you like to call him, and he'd call him about 3 times, Falcon Red Leader, this is, I forget the call sign of which you want, the base call sign, are you receiving me, are you receiving me, over. And then you get the answer back, hello Tom Tit, this is Falcon Red Leader, yes I am receiving you, yes I am receiving you, loud, well a long litany of things. Sheer waste of time, as you can imagine. Now, that particular radio set that the aircraft used in those days wasn't very much sort of state-of-the-art. If you dropped below about 500 feet and you were 2 miles away, you couldn't get in touch with either end. in order to know where our own aircraft were, there was a gadget called a pipsqueak on each of the Hurricanes. The pipsqueak was a radio transmission that lasted for 2 or 3 seconds, ordinary single note, that came up every quarter of a minute. So that if you had 5 separate lots of aircraft in the air, you were in dead trouble. You could deal with 4 because you set them for a quarter of a minute quadrant of each minute. So that assume you had red section in the air, you'd say, "Hello, red section, stand by to receive pipsqueak." You'd say 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, and as the clock came up onto the midday, he'd pip in, and his section was from sort of 60 down to 15. Yellow section, you'd try the next one, blue and yellow, and so on. Now, that was fine, except that these damn things were run on clockwork, and they weren't very good clockwork. So you can imagine that the thing slipped, you get red mixed up with yellow, and the poor devils who were working the 3 triangulation stations out in the marshes of Essex were hard put to it to know whose pipsqueak was coming up. You could do some sort of continuity on your tables, of course, and on your blackboards that you were plotting them on. Later on, we saw common sense, and we realised that if we said, "Hello, red section, transmit for fix," and he flicked his switch on, his transmitter on, then we could DF him on that just as equally as we could on a single monotone note. And by doing that, you could get umpteen people flying at the same time and still know where they were. Is this making sense to you, or am I being an utter bore? I don't mean to be.
Very clear.
Now, the end of 39, 40, thereabouts, we got rotor variable prop propellers on Hurricanes and Spits, definitely. We'd settled down to voice transmissions. You can check those dates. I can't guarantee them because I wasn't. We also had a decent VHF set, for, you know, very high-frequency radio sets, which meant that on one occasion, I think the controller was a chap called Squadron Leader Clinch. He had the first experimental VHF set up with a friend of his who was flying, and he was saying, "Can you get a bit lower?" And the answer came back, "Well, I'm just below tree level at the moment. I'm not going to run along the main road with this thing." And that meant that we could talk comfortably to people who were in the air without going through this stupid paraphernalia of sort of 4 or 5 repetitions of everything we said. Now, we had a fair time to practice, as you can imagine. We had the stupid pastime of doing patrols over convoys up and down the east coast from Harwich up to roughly Wells by the sea, which might have given some comfort to the Navy and to the Merchant Navy, but I doubt it. And it cost us an incredible number of very good pilots. Being nasty-minded about this. But if you're sitting doing a figure of 8 over a fixed point of a convoy and you're known to the opposition that you're there, that which comes out of the clouds above you doesn't give you much hope of survival. It's a nasty thought, isn't it? Now, we progressed until France fell. We provided cover for the Queen of Holland, coming out of Holland. Our Hurricanes did that. Our Hurricanes did the trips over to Dunkirk and were fairly successful over there. Out of our plotting range, obviously, we couldn't do very much to help them except bring them back if they were in trouble. And then we slowly got ready for the Battle of Britain, so-called. By that time, we were getting a little more clever in the ops room and a little more clever here and there. But we still had the rather stupid habit of not learning from the Germans or from the Spanish Civil War.
What could you have learned?
If you went to Hendon Air Show before the war, everybody wandered about in very tight squadron formation. They taught people to roll in formation, tied together with bits of string and that sort of thing. And our people were so busy flying, wingtip inside wingtip and tail unit of their neighbour, that they were too busy flying the damn thing and not looking for trouble. The Germans had got a much better idea. They flew fingers four, which meant that you had either two or four aircraft. They were in loose formation, spread across a fair amount of sky. They were not frightened of colliding with each other. They could each watch a sector of the sky around them. They could each watch each other's tail. They had a leader and a wingman in each pair, you see. Now, when we came to fight in the Battle of Britain in particular, we had the advantage of radar. It was RDF still in those days, which was a fairly simple method of detection. Now, I'm not going into the technical side of it, because although I did some time at Malvern, TRE, you know, the technical research place, I was never a great genius on radio or mathematics, for that matter. Now, if you take a radar station, an ordinary chain home low station, a detection station on the coast, that was a 360-foot high tower with two or three bands of aerials down it. Those aerials transmitted a fairly heavy blip of energy on about 1.5 metres, give or take a bit, I think it was about that, roughly the television frequency. And they belted this stuff out, rather like somebody shouting at a cliff wall. You got an echo back from whatever was floating about out to sea. And on a radar, on a cathode ray tube, which is only a form of stopwatch, you could see where the answer came. You could find the distance out and back, if you follow me. Now, the trouble lay in that type of radar set with height finding, which is critical, and with numbers. There is a peculiar formula which has stuck in my mind for over 50-something years, and that is 2h over lambda. H is the height and lambda is the wavelength. That gives you the number of lobes that an aerial will transmit. And if you can imagine a whole flock of sausage-shaped blips of energy going out, or sausages of energy going out from the aerial, if you vary the height of your aerial, you cannot vary the wavelength easily, then you can determine, if you're brilliant or got a warped mind, which lobe the return is coming in on. In other words, it could be 10,000 feet, 2,000 feet, or whatever you like, somewhere between them. Now, the Germans, instead of pounding hell out of our radar stations, tried, but they're very difficult to destroy. But we had got warning of stuff leaving France, taking off from France, circling, making their height to come over to England. That gave us the opportunity in places like 11 Group, not the main stations around London, not places like Manston, which was pounded to hell because we couldn't get people off in time, or Hawkinge. of getting them up in the air. Now, the pilots soon learned that if we said, we've got a target for you, vector 190, and we give them the code word for Maidstone or whatever you like, they would promptly turn 010 and climb like the clappers and get enough height to do something about the opposition. Again, it was a matter of time. I don't know the range of an MOA-109, which is the fighters that we had then, but I have a feeling somewhere in my water that they had something like something in the region of 8 minutes actual combat time. And then they had to bolt for home like the clappers, otherwise they'd be swimming gracefully across the channel, which really wasn't the object of the exercise. Now, a Spitfire or a Hurricane could hang about for about an hour and a half, but we were on our own patch. We could get a flight or a squadron off in 2 or 3 minutes. We got pretty agile at it. And as they climbed at about 2,000 feet a minute, I think that was roughly a battle climb speed, we could make enough height to deal with quite a few of the opposition at 10, 12,000 feet, which was a reasonable height to come in at. It was difficult. The Germans bombed our airfields quite successfully. Very uncomfortable. They destroyed the ops room at North Weald, put the fear of God into all of us who were on duty at the time. And we left there and went to the post office along in Ongar for a little while, where we had another ops room in the high street there.
Can you describe the attack on North Weald as you remember it?
Well, I was in the ops room at the time. And we watched the plots coming towards us. We sent up what we could. We sent all the odds and ends of Hurricanes that were on the ground into the air. And then a station lookout said, so many Junkers 88s are now attacking the airfield. He was remarkably calm about it. There were several bumps. The ops room shook up and down like a boat at sea. And we poor blighters got out in our filthy clothes and sat outside and waited for the panic to die down. Then we moved off to the second ops room, which was, oh, it's nothing very terrifying. You're too busy at the time to worry. What really did annoy me about that raid was that I had an old school blazer in the barrack room that we were in, and that vanished. I also had my last passport there. And I had the remains of an old Morgan that I was rebuilding, and a 250-pound bomb dropped on that, and all that was left was the driving mirror that I used as a shaving mirror for some time. You take this thing personally. But at any rate, we moved to an operations room which was dead over the top of an old post office at North Weald, at Ongar. Of course, it was nice and handy for the King's Head, which was next door. So as soon as you stopped work, you'd nip next door and had a quick drink. Very civilised way of fighting a war was that. I can always remember, again, the same squadron leader, Clinch. He was the second dicky in the Controllers League. Hanging out when there was a raid going over Ongar. Fairly large one, with Hurricanes sort of nibbling at the edges of it. And all the local population were standing in High Street Ongar, all looking up and high and looking at the fight up above them. And Clinch was hanging out saying, "You bloody fools, for goodness sake, go away. What goes up comes down." And the place was full of tinkling bits of brass linkage of bullets and stuff. It was the same place at Ongar that we were all detailed to dig a hole to put a forward transmitter on. Most of our transmissions went out from fixed sites, of course, you know, radio transmissions to them. We had forward transmitters at the coast. I'll tell you a bit about that later. But for sheer emergency sake, we had one transmitter that we had locally in a van or a fairly large Dodge truck. and we were afraid of its being shot by marauding 109s. So we dug a very large hole. We had a couple of surveyors on the crew. And in our spare time, as I say, we dug and we dug and we dug until we got a hole big enough to hide this thing in, apart from a tall whip aerial. And we went home contented after that. And we decided to drive the thing in the following day. And that night it rained like hell, and we got the largest duck pond you've ever seen, just behind Ongar Church. But the thing never went down. It was never shot anyway. Probably more use to the Germans than it was to us. Now, by this time, we were having a fair number of pilots shot down. As you can imagine, things were getting a bit fraught. You know, I'm sort of telescoping this considerably because lots of it is sheer bore. And often, early in the morning, we'd pick a couple of forward transmitters. One of us would talk on one of them, being red section, blue section or something. The other one would be the controller talking on the other one. And it used to disturb the Germans a bit because they were convinced that we had a patrol going up and down, you know, normal nonsense. And it saved our petrol and saved our time and gave us a nasty sense of, oh, well, that's annoying them anyway. Now, we finally took over an old mansion called Blake Hall, in between Ongar and Epping. There is a railway station there still, I think. And we built a very fine gin palace of an operations room in that. Oddly enough, it must have been a few months after it was built that one of the RAF regiment who were detailed to guard it nearly shot another one by letting a Sten gun poop off through the ceiling. And we used to go collecting pheasants with fish hooks and raisins. It was a marvellous place. Always get an odd pheasant round there. But it was only a little while afterwards that a very nasty gentleman came over one night, probably an old 88, and he laid down a stick of bombs that stopped, 150 yards from the main entrance to Blake Hall. Who told him about it? Goodness knows, but he didn't come back again, much to our relief. Now, this must have been 41-ish. It's getting on a bit, you know, the actual battle of Britain. And then we started to try to knock down the people beating up London, Coventry, Birmingham and places like that.
Before we go on to that, if I could just ask about the Battle of Britain. Did you feel that Britain was in imminent peril of invasion at that time?
At that time, I was convinced we were in imminent peril of invasion. On afterthought, what a damn silly question. We weren't. As I say, I come from a naval family of sorts. There was my old man beating up and down on the Dover Patrol. When you consider the size of our fleet then, our destroyers alone were double that of the German destroyer force. Not so good technically, but sheer number.